On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a week of shifting currents at home and abroad. Condoleezza Rice announcing the United States will negotiate with Iran if Tehran shuts down its nuclear program and standing shoulder to shoulder with allies in Vienna. But is that a real path to peace or road paving for war? Americans taking on board the civilian deaths in Haditha as more killings are alleged, and Iraq's prime minister himself accuses U.S. troops of killing Iraqi civilians every day. The Roberts-Alito Supreme Court gives a cold shoulder to whistleblowers, no relief on immigration, Paulson's in at Treasury. There's a lot to look at. Up next on Point, New Republic editor Franklin Foer, columnist Mona Charon, and our own Jack Beattie join us to look at the news of the week. Let's jump straight in with Iran and the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, of course, sitting down with in Vienna. Russia, China, France, Germany, the EU, all shoulder to shoulder saying, we'll negotiate with conditions. Let's listen to Condoleezza Rice.
As soon as Iran fully and verifiably suspends its enrichment and reprocessing activities, the United States will come to the table with our EU colleagues and meet with Iran's representatives.
The U.S. will come to the table if. The President Bush then said at a cabinet meeting yesterday, Iran has reached a critical fork in the road.
If they choose not to suspend and verify, if they continue their obstinance, they continue to say to the world, we really don't care what your opinion is, then the world is going to act in concert.
The world will act in concert. Mona Charon, what does that mean, then the world will act in concert?
Well, I don't know, and I'm not sure the President knows, because this very cobbled together alliance which includes Russia and China, who until now have been extremely recalcitrant about doing anything on Iran, have simply come together to offer a package of carrots. And I think that if Iran rejects it, the same divisions among these nations will reappear about what kind of stick to apply.
Franklin Foer, David Brooks says there are no optimists in this administration about the prospects for diplomacy, that this is kind of walking through this to get their gang together behind them, or at least to be seen as having done that. So is negotiation a real option here, or is this window dressing in anticipation of something military?
Well, over the course of the last month in Washington, there was a lot of gossip going around about the imminence of a military strike, and nobody seemed to be sure of what was actually going to go down. So to the extent that they're trying out this diplomatic option, I'm pretty glad. But I think that there's no good reason to be optimistic that the talks will end up in shutting down the Iranian nuclear program. But this at least seems to be the best effort that they're putting forward. I'm not sure that the administration actually really wants to attack Iran. I mean, I think that maybe Cheney and Bolton would be happy to do it, but I think that there was plenty of opposition within the administration that would consider that to be a pretty foolhardy thing to do that would completely jeopardize Iraq and would result in basically a long sustained conflict with Iran that we don't really want to be in.
Jack, yes, Mona, please.
Yes, I don't think anybody wants to attack Iran, but I think many members of the administration agree with John McCain that using military force against Iran would be the very worst option, except one, letting Iran become a nuclear power. And so, you know, obviously you do hope that there's some other way. The problem is that in order to enforce any kind of sanction, you have to get the approval of China and Russia, and they so far have balked at that. And so the U.S. is in a very, very difficult position, and Britain and the other countries who believe that that sanctions may be necessary.
Jack Beattie, how do you read the negotiation offer? Is this the new era of Condoleezza Rice, a whole new flavor in American foreign policy, or is this same road, different road signs?
Well, she said we would go to the table. She didn't say what we would do there or what we would bring to the table. And meanwhile, using the same language of table, John Bolton said yesterday that unilateral action, military action, is, quote, still on the table. You know, the crucial thing here, as with North Korea, is the security guarantee. And any American who wants peace and who wants to avoid war with a major country needs to get on the phone and to the email right now and tell their congressman to pressure this administration to put a security guarantee into this negotiation.
In other words, to let Iran know what?
To let Iran know we're not going to knock over their regime. That we accept their existence, that we're not going to destabilize them. And that, from what some people say, would be enough for them to at least to begin here. But if we just say, hey, get rid of your nukes and everything's going to be fine, wait a minute. The reason they accelerated the nukes is to keep us out of there in the first place. And, of course, we did put them in the axis of evil. So you call a country evil, then you invade its neighbor. The only way to keep us out is to get nukes. So unless we say to them, your regime is stable, we accept it, I don't think this goes anywhere.
Moni, you ready to put that guarantee on the table, security guarantee?
Exactly the opposite way. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that what we are dealing with in Iran is a country that didn't start being hostile to us when we called it a member of the Axis of Evil. It started being hostile to us the day that the Iranian Revolution took over in 1979.
We do recall that day, yes.
Yes, we don't have to go through the fact that they violated every universally observed diplomatic laws about, you know, not taking diplomats hostage and so on and so forth.
Of course, history goes back and back, Mossadegh and all the rest.
Well, right, but the Iranian regime has been at war with us in a low-grade way ever since Khomeini took power. They have been responsible for most of the terrorism around the world, most of the terrorism aimed at the United States. They have been a hostile power, and certainly if anyone was in any doubt about where they stood, Mr. Ahmadinejad has made it abundantly clear.
Would you give him a security guarantee? Would you put that on the table?
No, I think that what the United States should have been doing, and alas, this administration has not, I think, been aggressive enough on this front, we should have been helping the democratic opposition in Iran all this time with more than just words. We should have been funneling money and any other kind of support that they needed, because the vast majority of Iranians hate the regime. There have been enormous demonstrations in the streets by young people and others opposed to this regime. It is ripe, I think, for some kind of revolution. But it needs some assistance. And no, the last thing we should do is give them legitimacy. That's the one thing that we can confer on them that they want, and that we should not, because that will deny hope to the Democrats within Iran, who would love to be free of this regime. And if the Democrats prevail, one of the worst threats to world peace, namely the clerical regime in Iran, will disappear.
Frank Ford, we've got a lot to get to. A final comment here before we come back to it maybe later with our callers on Iran. Do you see this as heading into a muddle or into a breakthrough or to the Security Council and threat of force?
Just to add a few historical points, the first is that the Iranian nuclear program actually began under the Shah, and so it's deeply rooted in Iran's national ambitions, and is certainly those ambitions have been to an extent, shaped by the Iranian Revolution and by events in Iraq. But I think this is very longstanding. Secondly, we've attempted the so-called grand bargain before. In the Clinton administration, there was an offer that was put on the table that involved this sort of security guarantees, and it was rejected by the Iranians. So I'm not terribly optimistic that we're going to arrive at any sort of diplomatic solution, and I'm even less optimistic that we're going to see some sort of regime change in the immediate future, even if we were to fully apply American resources to doing that. It just seems like the Ahmadinejad regime is too firmly entrenched, even though there is a real meaningful democratic movement on the ground there. But people have been predicting its imminent rise for a decade or longer, and it just doesn't ever seem to reach critical mass.
Let's hold the phone on that. Mona Charon, Haditha, and now it's cousins in the news. Charges of U.S. military killing civilians unprovoked in cold blood, John Murtha says. The whole world is watching. Where does this take us, Mona?
Well, first of all, I think John Murtha did not cover himself with glory in all of this by rushing to accuse Marines before he knows the fact.
Well, he had been briefed, and many other sources inside now are saying they expect charges of murder.
Well, perhaps so, but we haven't yet heard from the Marines. We haven't yet seen the facts And I think for Murtha to accuse them of killing in cold blood, I mean, even that term.
He was briefed. We weren't. What do you think the impact's going to be?
It suggests that they acted with the deliberation, which under battlefield conditions is quite unlikely. But in any event, I think that what we will see over the next several weeks is quite an orgy of national self-flagellation, basically conducted mostly by liberals in the press who do not like war and don't think that war can ever be fought for noble purposes.
You're a conservative. What's your response to Haditha? What would you say to it?
I would say let us see if a crime was committed, and if so, punish those who perpetrated it, and bear in mind that under battlefield conditions, bad things sometimes happen. Frankly, we have conducted this, the military, with a few exceptions, like Abu Ghraib, has conducted itself quite admirably.
The president's been talking about immigration this week, hoping to get his party together on it as the Senate and House now go eyeball to eyeball. Let's listen to him here at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, pressing Congress to get an immigration bill to his desk.
The American people expect us to meet our responsibility and deliver immigration reform that fixes the problems in the current system, that upholds our ideals, and provides a fair and practical way forward.
Mona Charon, it's your party. Can the GOP deliver on immigration, or is it going to crack up?
Well, that is one of the great unknowns. We will see in November, I think. But
not till then?
Well, no, because you know, it's very unclear. You know, there is so much passion at the grassroots level about this issue, passion that is reflected in what members are hearing when they go home for town meetings, passion that is reflected on radio, talk radio, and so on. But it is not accurate. That same passion doesn't show up so far on public opinion polls, where immigration is not yet the top, not even close to being the top concern of voters who are polled. So it remains for voters to tell us whether this is a bridge too far, whether the Republican Party, having failed to deliver strict, which I think is probably what's going to happen, failed to deliver a strict immigration law, which seems to be what the grassroots are aiming at, will be punished at the polls by people simply, by Republicans staying home. We will see.
Frank Foer, take us to the Supreme Court and this decision on government whistleblowers. The Supreme Court, 5-4, with the newest members, Chief Justice John Roberts and Samuel Alito, saying, government employees, you cannot count on being backed up here if you complain within the ranks. We saw somebody disciplined there in the case before the court, and the court was not on his side. What does this mean?
Well, I mean, it seems like on its face, it seems like a big deal decision, given how corruption has kind of become one of the master narratives of the second Bush term. I'm not sure that this is really the end of whistleblowing. There's legislation that I think has a good chance of making its way through the Congress that would give some substantial protections to whistleblowers. But, you know, in the short term, where you actually do have some cases where it would seem like there would be some potential whistleblowers who could blow the top off of these scandals, I would think it would be a very chilling decision.
Jack Beatty, ACLU legal director, says in an era of excessive government secrecy, the court has made it easier to engage in a government cover-up by discouraging internal whistleblowing. Sam Alito's reputation coming in was he sided with power. And here's the vote.
And he's done it. You know, we have a situation where the Congress has capitulated. Right at this moment, perhaps, the government is probably breaking the law and probably violating the Constitution in monitoring American communications. And yet the Congress is doing nothing. There's no sanction on that. They've completely rolled over in an act of partisanship that really amounts to a betrayal of their constitutional office. And so now the one way in which stuff can get out through the whistleblower within the agencies, the court now wants to close that. I mean, this is a scary proposition. You know, to get back for a minute to the immigration thing, Bush is now at 51% among conservatives. And if anything goes forward in a positive way on immigration, in the way of the rolling amnesty in the Senate bill, that's going to hurt him among conservatives. And just as Mona says, that's going to dry up the motivated vote in November. And there's another poll just out that really highlights Bush's overall problem and perhaps even gets into the immigration, shows why Republicans may not be so cowed by him. The Quinnipiac poll of Americans generally asked who the worst president in American history was. More than by 2-1, people picked Bush more than anyone else, the next contender being Richard Nixon.
Yeah, speaking of conservatives, let's listen to one thing, then I want to open the phones. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us, Frank, Mona, Jack. But let's hear first from Mr. Bill O'Reilly. This week, interesting, saying on his Fox News program that Iraq may now be an unwinnable war.
That's the truth. Terrorism is here to stay. Muslim fanatics are not going anywhere. So what should the USA do? Well, the first thing is to be realistic. If we could go back to the fall of 2001, right after 9/11, you'd still have to invade Afghanistan. No way could the USA allow al-Qaeda to remain there. But Iraq should be a lesson learned. We cannot ever again put American boots on the ground in a hostile Arab country. Iraq was an optional war. There will always be, or there were other ways, I should say, of removing Saddam.
Mona Charon, is this a Walter Cronkite moment, Bill O'Reilly on the Iraq war, unwinnable?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think you can compare the influence of Walter Cronkite and Bill O'Reilly. He's one voice. Bill is one voice among many, and doesn't command that kind of influence.
Not exactly a puny kid in the choir.
No. But look, you know, I think Victor Davis Hanson put it well when he said, when he was arguing for why we must win in Iraq, and he said, the question now will be whether we will prevail and change the entire Middle East to their benefit and our own, or whether Iraq and Afghanistan will be seen as giant Mogadishus.
Mm. And what about Haditha? Here's President Bush at a cabinet meeting yesterday saying the truth on Haditha will be known.
I expect this investigation to be conducted independent of the White House with a full and thorough investigation. And I'm confident. Listen, the Marine Corps wants to get to the bottom of this.
Robert's calling from Governor New York. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to look at, you know, kind of back away and look at a larger picture of this situation with Islamic fundamentalism. I've really wanted to say this for a long time. I just want to say that I've come into this little philosophical thing, basically saying the issue is not the issue.
What do you mean, Robert? Are you I see here you're a Christian pastor.
Yes, I am.
So what are you saying?
Well, I'm conservative, but I guess I'm a little bit different than most conservatives. What I'm trying to say is that you know, I've always wondered why can they call us the Great Satan? You know, all these Islamic fundamentalists, and I really thought a lot about it. And the only thing I can come up with is the idea that, you know, they look at us and we're supposed to be a Christian nation, and I'm not saying we are or not, but I'm saying that's the supposed view. And yet, our motivation seems to be purely profit-driven. You know, we're capitalists. And
so you think it's an honest critique of the United States rather than a nationalistic or chauvinistic, you know, push from the Islamic side?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part, but I think I know what you said.
Yeah.
The point is that I think that our energy should be shifted from trying to figure out and trying to stopgap all of the things we think is crazy over there, and start worrying about our own morality and ethics here in the country, because we don't hear much about that.
The Reverend speaks. Mona Charon.
Can I make a couple points?
Yes,
first
please.
Of all, I'm all for, you know, looking to our own morality and ethics. We can certainly use some work on that score, but I certainly would not bow to the Islamic world in terms of their observation of morality and ethics. Look at the way they treat women. Look at the way they treat children. Look at their judicial system. You know, on any number of levels, they are quite primitive and cruel in the way they treat their fellow man. Let me just also make a comment about Jack Beatty's point on this business of the dress code in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
You're
talking
Amir
Tahari, about the story out there that Jews might be asked to identify themselves in the streets of Iran.
Jews, Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians, who protect so-called protected religious minorities. There would have been another dress code entirely for people who didn't fall into any of those categories. But this was Amir Tahari stands by the story. It was passed by the Islamic Majlis and was submitted to the Council of Guardians, which is the true power in Iran. And the disposition remains uncertain as to whether this will become law, but it definitely was passed. It definitely was considered. He did not make it up.
Franklin Ford, let me ask you on this issue of regime change. Mona says she really doesn't want to go to war with Iran. If negotiations don't work, let's change the regime. I mean, here's an example. I don't know the facts of it, but of how far things can go here. Do you see this as a changeable regime, or do we just have to live with it?
I mean, there's the metaphor that's widely used, that there are two ticking clocks. One is the clock that's ticking down to Iran's procurement of a nuclear weapon. And the second is the clock ticking down on the life of the Iranian regime. And it seems like that over the long run, there's probably a significant enough discontent and a viable enough democratic movement within Iran that at some point in the future they'll be able to challenge the Islamic regime. But I have no confidence that that's going to happen anytime in the short term. It seems to me that if you look at the history of the reform movement, which is exhausted, and if you just look at the pronouncements that have been made over the course of the last 20 years about the prospects for Iranian democratic movement emerging and strongly challenging the regime, it never happens. And that might be. And I think that the regime is very deft in dealing with its opposition. They know Ahmadinejad, despite his conservatism, has expanded the rights of the populace to engage in various forms of cultural expression, which are essentially meaningless towards challenging the regime. They give and take.
Frank, let me go to the core of Robert's question, though. Do you see this as a moral contest at any level, at some level, between Islam in the West? Is it a rejection of modernity with Haditha and all the civilian killings by terrorists? Is it a moral race to the bottom? How do you see the sort of big dynamic of this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's undoubtedly a moral contest. I mean, if you look at the theology of the Islamic regime, I mean, it's undeniably grounded in a moral religious worldview, and undoubtedly it is on our side as well. But I think before you get to that point, you've got to deal with this as a security threat. I mean, if you look at the threat of proliferation, if you look at Iran's attitude toward martyrdom, its connections to terrorism, I'm not endorsing military strikes here, but I think you would have to be deeply unsettled by the prospect of these guys obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Let's go to Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Bob. Hi, Bob. You're on the line.
Yes, just a comment I wanted to make about the Iranian situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, in some way, at least in a discussion today, there's not been anything said about the fact of Israel's involvement in this. I don't personally believe that Israel would sit around in the absence of the American military doing something, knowing that there's a nuclear capability coming, and a man making the comments that he's made about Israel. I don't remember all my history, but I know on several occasions Israel's acted on their own self to defend themselves, and I believe that they're very capable of doing it and have already kind of alluded to the fact that that's a possibility. And, it may be a situation where America's going to have to react to Israel's response.
And we just had Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in town. Jack Beattie, what about it? I mean, we're talking about Russia and China and the EU. What about the Israel factor in the Iran nuclear standoff?
Well, you know, this isn't going to happen tomorrow. Even Negroponte says they're 10 years away from this. And so the Israelis have a long time to figure out what to do, and so do we. What worries me is the comment by Seymour Hersh a few months ago, where he had some sources who said Bush really believes that unless he stops Iran, it'll be too late. His successor won't do it. And that in some ways he sees himself as a man of destiny. And here's where Bush's decline in the polls could actually make an attack more likely, that he just may feel, this is what I get for doing the right thing. I've got nothing to lose. it's really worrisome. And, of course, you know, we also have heard, and we have to say this, the president said to a Jordanian interviewer that God, that he actually had conferred with God about the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, and one hopes God isn't talking about Iran. You know, on this issue of the yellow, quote, yellow journalism from the issue of the Mr. Tahiri, here is today's Jewish Week, a New York, serving the Jewish community of Greater New York, quoting the deputy editor of the National Post of Canada, how he went with the story. He resolved to go, this is the column, he resolved to go with an astonishing, but as it turned out, completely inaccurate opinion column by Iranian-American writer Amir Tahiri. And then he goes on for three or four pages on how it was inaccurate. So that's my source.
We got it. I want to let that one rest just because we're not going to settle here. But Mona, let me ask you about this assertion of that Israel may call the tune, the president anointed in his own mind, perhaps, to deal with Iran. How do you see that?
It's obviously in Israel's interest to give out the notion that they could do something about this, but a number of the military analyses that I have read suggest that this might indeed be beyond Israel's capacity. There are as many as 100 different sites, it is speculated.
So even though they did it with Iraq years ago, not with Iran.
If they dealt with Iraq, that was one site, and it was a lot closer to Israel. This is further away, and there are multiple sites, many of which are underground. By the way, Negroponte did not say it would be 10 years before Iran could have a bomb. I'm looking at Reuters. America's top intelligence official said Iran could have a nuclear bomb by 2010. That is 4 years from now.
Right. Well, we've seen that range. We've seen it. He said 10. He said 3 or 4. I mean, every time they come out with these estimates, there's a range. And, of course, that's part of what makes it scary. Ken's calling from Rockville, Maryland. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen, ladies. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Ken?
I'm actually active duty military. I served in Anbar province, right in the middle of Ramadi.
So you've been in the thick of it?
Yes. During the whole Fallujah and Ramadi, I was right there.
So how is all this Haditha business striking you?
I must say I'm very embarrassed and ashamed, by the way, how the military, as well as some of our political leaders, are dealing with this. When you're there in the thick of things, you know, I guess we in America tend to think that people in Iraq are kind of naive and, you know, honest and innocent about how they deal with this, but they're not. There's a reason why you can't trust the Iraqi police officers over there, because they lie all the time. They lie. They're double-handed.
I don't think anybody doubts that it's tough and ambiguous on every front, but then here we have dead children, little girls. What do we do with that? How do you see it, Ken?
Well, you know, I saw a lot of little girls, little boys, right? There, a lot of people were using these little kids as a shield, number one. That happens all the time. They were hiding weapons in their clothes when they're fighting us. I mean, things like this happen all the time. And for us to kind of jump on it and say, all right, there's a 3 or 4 year old girl that shot. Now it's got to be a murder. Well, I think we need to give our military the benefit of the doubt.
A 1 year old was shot. Do you think it may, by a bullet, we're told. Do you think it may come out that that was necessary in the military course of things?
You know, you can't make that judgment call because some of these insurgent guys are actually using their 2 or 3 year old girls to walk down the small back alley so we can't fire at them, and then using them as shields, literally.
Yeah.
And they would hide and snap at us again and then walk down the alley again with a 2 year old girl.
Ken, we know you've been there, and we know it's hard, and still these deaths stand there, and they're not easy to deal with. But thank you for your call and for your service. Muhammad is calling from Waterford, Connecticut. Hi, Muhammad. You're on the air.
Good morning, sir. I was talking about the Iranian government.
Yes. What do you think of it?
The government, the first place, you know, the United States, before attack Iraq, they should get rid of the Iranian government because the government is support terrorists in that region. Those are the ones troublemaker.
Are you Iranian, Muhammad?
I am Iranian. I've been in this country 28 years.
What do you think the U.S. government should do with Tehran now on the nuclear front?
Okay, nuclear front. Right now, there is a severe sanction. Not hurt the people, hurt the government.
Mm-hmm. So don't let them travel. Go after the bank accounts, as Mona Charon and Frank were saying.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So sanction them and do it quick. Muhammad, we've got it. Armand is calling from Washington, D.C. Armand, you're on the air.
Yes, I am. I'm actually representing a viewpoint that's contrary to the previous caller.
Okay.
I think sanctions, a lot of people are talking about what sanctions will do and how it's necessary. I think sanctions will be contrary to what we want in Iran. It will only strengthen the government.
Why?
And, well, I mean, we saw it in Iraq. The government gets around any sanctions. They bought and sold oil. We just convicted a guy from Texas who was buying Iraqi oil. They will get around it, and the government wants that, because then the biggest problem Iranian government has right now is the fact that their economy is in trouble, and the youth in Iran wants jobs, and that's the big point. They're trying to calm them down. They're trying
to find
jobs.
But if they won't negotiate, we don't know that yet, but if they don't, if they won't, and if you don't want to go to war or do military strikes, what's left other than sanctions? Can we wait for the regime change Monitor's talking about?
The sanctions, what it will do is it will allow the Iranian government to suppress all opposition, blame any trouble with the economy on the West and the United States. That's exactly what happened when actually Iraq invaded Iran, and the government said, oh, well, the economy's in trouble because Iraq is invading us. It allowed the government, allowed the rally around the flag, just like after
it's
September 11th.
It looks
the government
difficult.
Can do anything it wants because it's under pressure. And people will see it as a foreign influence as opposed to Iranian officials being corrupt, Iranian officials not doing their jobs. It will do exactly what it wants. Even if we attack the Iranian government or hit them like Israel hits Iran or the United States bombs some nuclear sites, that will give Ahmadinejad exactly what he wants.
I mean, you've got some serious people saying they're going to have the bomb at the end of the day. Let me get one more call. Hassan is calling from Boston. Hassan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask you if you knew of the chief negotiator of the Islamic Republic coming out earlier this year and lying straight out that during 2002 to 2004, they constantly lied to the EU3 and kept them going while they were conducting their activities.
I mean, we're not surprised. What do we make of it? Should we negotiate?
I mean, when Jack mentions that we should give him legitimacy, well, this is who you're giving legitimacy to. I think he should know that.
So what do you do?
Well, you have to go, just like Mona said. You have to tell them they definitely have to get rid of the nuclear weapons, technology that would lead into nuclear weapons. And this is a problem with the regime, because Iran used to have nuclear technology during 1962. They started... with the aid of
right.
America.
A long history, even under the Shah. Hassan, thanks for your call. Jack, legitimacy, legitimize through negotiation, undermine, as Mona says. How do you deal with this tough one?
It's a tough one, and the nationalist card is always there. People do think about the great Satan. Yes, I'm sure we're very popular in Iran among people, but they're also Iranians, Persians. They're very proud of that, and there's a nationalist element in all of this that in the building of the weapon, in the competence that these people have displayed. We can't miss that. That's very important, and we don't want to get in a situation where our reaction actually further entrenches that regime. You know, I mean. The axis of evil comment, according to what I've read, actually greatly undermined the opposition in Iran. I mean, that was a case of a boomerang.
Mona Chairman, we've got half a minute here. Is your guy, George Bush, finding his feet in this week, or is he still on that slippery pole slope?
Well, I don't know whether this will do anything to help his approval ratings. I think that as you can hear from the conversation today, none of us would really like to be in his shoes at this moment. This is a very, very difficult situation with Iran, and he's doing the best he can. My view is that by rewarding Iran, in effect, by, you know, once they've threatened to build a nuclear weapon, we finally agree to negotiate with them after 26 years of not doing so, it's a clear reward for their misbehavior. So I think that's a non-starter.
George Bush's shoes. Of course, he helped cobble them. Mona Charon, syndicated columnist, political analyst, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Franklin Foer, editor of the New Republic magazine. Frank, wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, good to have you as always. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, good talking with you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.